I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Baltimore is in the running for a $30 million federal grant that could be the spark behind a massive new development that would connect the upscale Harbor East neighborhood to Johns Hopkins Hospital. Planners envision 200 acres of housing, a new school, and a park. Would this project lift up neighborhoods that have long faced major challenges, or would it exacerbate a history of racial inequity? We'll talk about the plan, the impact on the city, and the consequences for the current residents in the area with Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal and Klaus Philipson, the author of Baltimore, Reinventing an Industrial Legacy City. Plus, activist Brittany Oliver, the founder of Not Without Black Women, stops by in advance of the Women of the World Festival this Saturday. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome on this Monday afternoon to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Baltimore is one of six U.S. cities now competing for a $30 million federal grant that city planners hope will launch a major redevelopment project in East Baltimore. More than 1,300 public housing units and a school would be demolished in what could eventually be a billion-dollar transformation of a 200-acre tract between Harbor East and Johns Hopkins Hospital in the Perkins, Somerset, Old Town neighborhoods, a part of the city long marked by blight, vacancies, and violent crime. If the Housing and Urban Development Grant is awarded to Baltimore this summer and additional financing can be secured, the project could begin as early as next year. There is the possibility that the Perkins Homes, a large public housing complex, as well as City Springs Elementary School, would be torn down as part of this huge project. So does this mean that current residents would be displaced? Could this project lead to more racial segregation and less affordable housing? Melody Simmons is a reporter with the Baltimore Business Journal and a veteran observer of the city's real estate and development scene. She's here in the studio. Hey, Mel, good to see you.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
And Klaus Philipson joins us as well. He's an architect who writes and lectures widely about urban design, city architecture, preservation, and transportation issues. He's the author of Baltimore, Reinventing an Industrial Legacy City, and his commentaries on urban design appear frequently on his blog, Community Architect, and a regular contributor to our program. Good to see you, Klaus.
Hello.
If you'd like to join our conversation about what's happening down in Harbor East, this is the tract of land that would connect, in a way, Harbor East, which is that upscale sort of ritzy neighborhood downtown, the Whole Foods and all that stuff, with Hopkins Hospital to the east. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming the festivities here in Studio A on Facebook Live. So, Melody Simmons, give me a sense of the scope of this project, what they're proposing.
It's a big scope. It's 200 acres total, which is quite a large swath of land for an urban area. If you drive it, you can visualize it very easily. Head east, look from Caroline straight out. You can go north to the hospital, and you can kind of see some of the areas that are kind of crying out for redevelopment or some new birth. Head a little east, you're going to see Old Town. I always said it looks like a zombie movie set out there. And I think that that area is just crying out for some new development, too. This project has been discussed for many years, but there's been no money, no action. Plans have started and stalled and stopped. So this seems to be a new breath of fresh air for the redevelopment of this area.
So I guess about 20 cities nationwide have applied for this HUD grant,
yes,
which would be about $30 million, but that would only that's not by any means the scope of the money that would be invested in this. I as I understand it, this would sort of be the first installment in what could be as much of as a $1 billion.
Yes, it's a big price tag. The Choice Neighborhoods grant from HUD is only $30 million to Baltimore. I say only in quotes because that would be the kickoff money. That would be the money that's needed to start the work on the public housing development Perkins Homes. It's about 70 years old. Some of those units are not even, they're not inhabitable. Some of them are old. They don't work right. So the thought is it's time to remove them, tear them down, rebuild some kind of a new housing in there. Would be a mixed community. And that would, this money, if the city is awarded it, would be the money that would kick off all of that change.
And by mixed community, we're talking about housing that costs different levels.
That's right, mixed income. The residents of Perkins right now, the current residents, would be moved temporarily till the new units are rebuilt, and then would be moved back in. The Choice Neighborhoods grant has a one-to-one replacement, so no one will be displaced who's currently a resident.
Right, so they are required Perkins. To make sure if you're living in that neighborhood now,
right.
Once this development happens, you have to be able to live in that neighborhood.
Right.
Again.
There was some question about the Somerset site, which is over near right near Old Town. And that was torn down with some Hope 6 money, which didn't have that one-to-one replacement. So a lot of advocates and community activists are watching that plan to see what the replacement will be for the level of affordable to low-income housing in that area.
And Klaus Philipson is a person who studies this kind of thing very closely, not just here in Baltimore, but literally around the world. From what you know about the developer's intentions and aspirations here, how does it strike you?
Well, first, I hate to correct you, but it is not 1,300 units that get demolished. It's only 668 units.
Possibly Douglas.
Douglas
and
is
then
not
you
currently
add in,
Douglas
Somerset,
is another,
which is already down.
That's another that would public be housing project. Another,
1,300 is the grand number.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, but currently that's not included in the application for this grant, and it. But aside from that, I said 2002 at Perkins to have a Saturday workshop with community members, with the tenant council, and so on, to discuss a 9 million something improvement on Perkins homes that never came to happen. But at the time, they talked about making the flat roof sloped and making the units, you know, reconfigure.
So they were talking about renovating the building, not demolishing it.
Right. At that time, it was a lot more modest. And then I think the money actually disappeared because the housing department had to make units accessible under the ADA rules elsewhere. And so then that money wasn't there anymore. And then in 2016, it was awarded to BD Development for redevelopment. And this is part of this new trend that the housing department works with private developers and privatizing essentially public housing. So that is a whole topic in itself. But then the debate was to make it work that there is a one-to-one replacement of all the affordables and still a mixed-income community, because Baltimore also lives under the consent decree that you have to disperse poverty and have no concentrations of poverty. That would have meant usually the mix is one-third, 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 one-third low-income, lower low-income and one-third middle income and one-third market rate. And if you wanted to do that and one-to-one replacement, you would have to have 1,800 units instead of 600 or so. And that would be significant density. So that was also debated and rejected. And so the new trick in the book here is to include the Somerset side, former public housing that is currently a blank slate, and Old Town into the deal. And this way, the way it is presented is there will be 1,300 some new units, and they will consist of 652 deeply affordable, which would replace pretty much every single one and a few extra ones of Perkins. And then 276, 60% average AMI,
Average median income?
Something like that. Yeah, average and median is not the same. It's something like that. Area median income, that's what it is. And 417 market rate. So that would add up to 1,345 total new units. And they would be beginning the construction on the Somerset side. And so that would mean that the people that are displaced by the demolition in Perkins could relocate to Somerset, and then not.
And how far away is that, Melanie?
Somerset is probably about a mile and a half, 2 miles away as the crow flies. The Perkins home site is kind of a prime real estate now. If you drive down there, it's very close to the Liberty at Harbor East, which is going up, which is going to have a new Whole Foods. So that development moving north towards the hospital, that whole area, when that public housing development comes down, is going to become more desirable as a place to live because it's in the corridor. Central Avenue has already been widened. And so there's just a lot of activity that way. There is some concern about the Perkins residents being relocated over to the Somerset site. There is a discussion about possibly allowing them the option to move back to the Perkins site after the units are rebuilt.
And does this work, Klaus, as a matter of planning policy and as a matter of psychology? I mean, when it comes to subsidized housing, when I think about subsidized housing in Baltimore County, it's always NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard. There's plenty of places where moving to opportunity and those kinds of programs where they try to move people from impoverished neighborhoods in Baltimore City to various areas in the county, better schools, lower crime rates, better standard of living. There's an awful lot of resistance to that in many neighborhoods in Baltimore County. So what's happened actually, as I understand it from talking to people who are running for county executive in Baltimore County, for example, is that that poverty again tends to be concentrated. It's in East Baltimore County. Is it feasible? Is it doable? And are there examples here in Baltimore where there are people at various levels of income living side by side?
Essentially, the housing department has been doing this ever since they started the Hope 6 program. So in each of the cases where Lexington Terrace and Lafayette Courts and there were Murphy Homes. So there were five of these. In every case, the replacement of public housing was with mixed income communities, in part. So in the case of Murphy Homes that became Heritage Crossing, there's even a portion of home ownership in there. So that worked, and these communities, the last one, Flag House, became Albemarle Square, has also commercial components in it, and it is a real kind of mixed community with mixed uses, mixed incomes, and a certain amount of urban density that actually was the last one and therefore worked the best because one learned a lot of lessons. So yes, that can work, but what the opponents of the strategy on Hope 6 say is that every single time the amount of affordable housing that was available in the city or was under the control of the housing department got diminished because they never built back the high rises, they never built back the full density, they never built back the entire amount of affordable housing. So from that stems the current desire to say there got to be a one-to-one replacement. And that in turn then either adds density or you spread it over a wider area. And then that would be the good part. And when you look at the East Baltimore scenery there, you know, you have Harbor East, which you said is like very posh. And then you have public housing. Then you have Fells Point, which is also thriving. And then to the north, you have the EBDI area north of Hopkins that gets rehabilitated. In between is Fayette Street Corridor. Is also coming along. Mm-hmm. And so Somerset and Old Town were kind of disconnected over there and waiting for a future. And many say this has also to do with the elevated expressway that kind of separates it from downtown. So the idea to take three fundamental large parcels and rebuild them with mixed income and mixed use and at the same time not displace anybody has a lot of merit.
Yeah, and Melody Simmons, they're talking about tearing down the school, City Springs
yes.
Elementary, and then rebuilding that, right?
Yes.
Or on the same site?
In a new location.
Uh-huh.
And that area or that new school would have a lot of community aspects to it. And that would be paid for with a TIF, which we haven't mentioned yet, but there are plans and discussions going on right now about seeking a TIF district.
So that's my next question, because we talked a lot about TIFs a year or so ago when mm-hmm. Under Armour decided to, radically change the development at Port Covington. So this is tax increment financing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who think that that's a tax giveaway to developers. Explain how it would work in this instance.
Well, normally what it is, it's private bonds that are sold on the market to private developers. Well, they're city-backed bonds sold to private developers. investors, I mean private investors, and those bonds go to pay for infrastructure, new sidewalks, new lighting, new under the ground pipes. In this case, they would have to upgrade a lot of the cables that go on the east side, because that area where Perkins Homes is has not been upgraded. So this would be called, they're calling this loosely a community TIF, and that means that the TIF itself would go to pay to better the community in so many ways, not only in infrastructure, but what this with this new school.
And by infrastructure,
as well.
you're talking about streetlights and paving and sidewalks
roads.
And that roads and that type of stuff.
Essentially public investment. And it is a tax giveaway, but not of existing income, but of an income that you would never have if you didn't have the project. So the payback happens from the increased tax that the project would generate. And so then, of course, in the end of the day, if you assume the project would happen without the TIF too, you are giving it away. But then the criterion for the TIF is that if you wouldn't give the TIF, the project would
not happen anyway.
They call that the but for.
Let's take a little break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about this. Klaus Philipson is a Baltimore architect who writes and lectures on urban design and city architecture. His book is called Baltimore: Reinventing an Industrial Legacy City. Melody Simmons covers real estate and economic development for the Baltimore Business Journal. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To find us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. You can follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWIPR. And you can find us on the Facebook page at WIPR as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, another in our continuing series of conversations with the candidates. Joining me in the studio will be two Democratic rivals for the state Senate seat for District 43 here in Baltimore, incumbent Senator Joan Carter Conway. She's held that seat since 1997, and her challenger, Delegate Mary L. Washington, who's represented the district in the House for the past 8 years. Plus, Maryland Matters co-founder Josh Kurtz is going to spotlight some of the other interesting state legislative races in the run-up to the June 26th primary election. So that's all coming up tomorrow, right here on Midday. Later in this hour, I'll be talking with social activist Brittany Oliver. She's the founding director of Not Without Black Women. She's one of many speakers who will be featured at the Women of the World Festival here in Baltimore this weekend. And if you're just joining us, my guests are reporter Melody Simmons, who covers real estate and development issues for the Baltimore Business Journal, and Klaus Philipson, a Baltimore architect and the author most recently of Baltimore: Reinventing an Industrial Legacy City. We're talking about the city's proposed $1 billion redevelopment plan for East Baltimore and what that massive project could mean for the city and for the people who are living in the Perkins, Somerset, Old Town neighborhoods. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Klaus Philipson, in your book, you talk about cities that are elastic and inelastic. You talk about the need for transit-based development. Does this project here on the east side of our city meet any of the requirements of things that you would like to see when people undertake a large project like this?
Yeah, in the book, I take up the issue of elastic, inelastic that David Rusk brought up in his book, Baltimore Unbound, and in which he said that the city was beyond a point of no return and that it couldn't thrive because it was hemmed in by the county city lines, and that the city is, thanks to 1940s legislation, not allowed to annex anything anymore. And there is only one other city that is not part of a county or is not merged with the county, and that's St. Louis, and both cities are not doing all that well.
And the notion of merging Baltimore County and Baltimore City, you know, pops up every so often. Just a month or so ago, there was a piece in the Sun about it, but there doesn't seem to be any serious consideration.
So that would be a whole different discussion in itself. But I took the issue up because, A, Baltimore certainly didn't go further down the hill since Rusk wrote the book in the 90s, and it also leaves out the possibility to redevelopment and intensify use inside the city boundaries, which is what we have been doing. You know, as a former industrial city, we have a lot of brownfields and more or less derelict areas that can be redeveloped, the Port Covington being one. And this here is another case where you could intensify these two-story or three-story public housing projects from the 40s that were done in response to a housing shortage back then. And they are not done very well, and they are not very interesting to live in, obviously, because they're just these rows of buildings that were popped down without any urban space making, place making, and so forth. So the identification is the good part. What we have to kind of back up a little bit, you know. So East Baltimore, the whole landscape was just very nicely described in the Guardian's article. The British Daily wrote about Baltimore in an extensive, long article about that whole issue of EBDI, the East Baltimore development.
That's the big Hopkins development on the east
north
side.
Right, north,
yeah, north of the hospital.
Where there are a lot of bad feelings about this type of urban renewal. Now, in that case, there were many hundreds of families actually displaced, although they did get money and they, so to speak, went voluntarily, and they could have come back and they didn't. And so this whole thing of dispersing to areas of opportunity and dispersing poverty has been done there, and people were getting money so that they have now houses that are worth a lot more than they used to be in the EBDI area. But they're still unhappy because it's not all about numbers. It's also about people and community and social capital. And this is, so we are learning, you know, from each one of these redevelopment projects another lesson. And so the one-to-one replacement is a good lesson. But then if people get moved from Perkins to Somerset, then they are still not in the same area anymore. And
because if you're without a car and the transit isn't so great, you know, a mile and a half, 2 miles away is a long way away.
And
it's
the transit
from your former neighborhood.
Yeah. You know, every time I get an opportunity, I cry about the Red Line not being there, because this would have been a fantastic project that would tie East-West and the middle together. And it's still a needed project, and I always advocate that it needs to come back and it needs to be brought back in.
Yeah, let me go to the phones, Klaus, for a second, because we do have a number of folks lined up. Stephen in Timonium, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi. I have a question for Melody. Aunt Mel, while you were with the Daily Record, you did a big investigative piece about Johns Hopkins Biocorridor. And if I remember correctly, the issue was that a lot of demolitions occurred, leaving a lot of the renters without places to live. But then the new construction and influx of biotech money either lagged behind what was expected or just simply never occurred. So first of all, how does this proposed project compare in size and scope to the biotech corridor one? And second, if we do get this federal grant, how do we run the risk of, or do we run the risk of something similar happening again? And what can our leaders do to prevent that?
All right, thanks for the call. Stephen and Melody, you did cover EBDI over on the east side and north of it. And obviously, when a project is this big, people draw comparisons. How do you think they line up next to each other?
They do. Thank you for the call, Stevie. I do think that this project is double. The one that's being proposed now is double the size of EBDI. And EBDI was 88 acres. Joan Jacobson and I at the Daily Record, we dug into some of the history there and exactly looked at the decade, what happened to 732 families who were displaced. I think, as Klaus mentioned, that there
and
are...
As I remember, they were offered money for the homes they were living in, right?
They were offered packages. They had to fight for them. There were many plans. There were about three or four master plans. So that whole community evolved over the years, over 15 years. It's still evolving. A lot of them wanted to move back, but there wasn't any housing to move back into. So a lot of the lessons that were learned are being written into the grant application for Choice Neighborhoods. They are also being used in the blueprint. You have private developers on the south, I call it the south side of the hospital project, the Perkins Homes Transformational Project. And those private developers are looking to not make the same mistakes that EBDI had.
And Klaus Philipson, you've written on your blog and in your book about the notion of equity when it comes to these kinds of projects, because we should remind folks that this is a city project. The city has applied to the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department for $30 million. So this is coming from the Baltimore Housing Department. But in a recent blog, you noted that the city spent $25 million redeveloping about four blocks or five blocks on Charles Street, right around the studios in which we sit, from like 29th Street up to the Hopkins campus, right? But they spent, they also spent $25 million on 5 miles worth, not blocks, but miles worth of North Avenue, the other big street that intersects the city east-west the way that Charles intersects the city north-south.
Exactly. This equity issue is the big elephant in the room. So Brookings just issued a report last week where they compared 70 cities, former old industrial cities like Baltimore, and Baltimore ranked actually pretty good. But the upshot of that whole report was that these older industrial cities have only a chance to really get to the forefront and be a thriving, economically thriving city again if they consider equity. And Richard May from the West Baltimore Innovation Village always says, how can we thrive if we have two-thirds of the players not even on the playing field? And he means the 66% of African-American population that we have. So we definitely have a history that is totally not equitable in the investment and in the distribution of resources. And now the good news is that if investment comes to East Baltimore and a part of East Baltimore that would be considered a disinvested area, then that would be good. But then there are the optics of that the developer is the same one that does Harbor Point. Now, he's going to bring development partners that are actually really very experienced with affordable housing, like McCormick Salazar, to the table. But the optics are not so good. And also the empowerment zone designation that Harbor Point has it because Perkins Home is in the same district. So these kinds of things are the legacy that we have to carry along, and we have to watch out, because when EBDI was started, there were a lot of people said then we need to protect people against displacement and we need to have an equitable development, and we see that was not easy to do.
Yeah, Tom in Mount Vernon, welcome to Midday. You've got a question about this economic empowerment zone that Klaus just mentioned.
Yes, I sure do. The economic empowerment zone that Harbor Point applied for and received several years ago during development. In order to do that, they drew their lines up to encompass Perkins Homes with the promise that this Perkins Homes people would have employment in Harbor Place. Now, if Perkins Homes is destroyed, what happens with the economic empowerment zone designation that Harbor Point has?
Melody Simmons, what do you think?
It's a great question. It's been asked, and we're uncertain about where that leads. And they were allowed a tax credit, the Empowerment Zone tax credit, as part of their package to build Harbor Point. And so it's very unclear as to what will happen now if Perkins Homes comes down.
And Klaus Philipson, you write that population growth is a key metric that influences, you know, most of the other metrics of any city, right? And our population has been declining. I mean, it peaked here in Baltimore in the 1950s, you know, when it was 1 million plus. Now we're at about 620,000. We'll see what happens in the next census in a year or two. But it doesn't seem, I mean, the former mayor, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, made a commitment to 10,000 new families. It doesn't seem like they are flocking in, at least heretofore.
Well, there are people flocking in. We have a fairly good growth in the so-called millennials and young, upwardly mobile people. that any city wants to have, but we are losing at the same time even slightly more people. So we have not really achieved that population growth. And the growth in itself isn't a goal in itself, but a city needs a tax base. And a city like Baltimore and many other former industrial cities have so self-segregated that everybody who has an opportunity kind of left the city. And you can't run a city with people that are just left behind, not by choice, but because they didn't get another opportunity. So we need to have a much more diverse population, and that can, if you don't want to displace anybody, which, you know, I certainly wouldn't propagate, then the best way is to add something. And so I'm always for keeping people where they are and add new ones. And that can be done in Oliver, for example. The Guardian quotes the developer there. They didn't displace a single household and still brought the community back.
We did a program last week with Lawrence Brown of Morgan State University, who had a panel going on at UMBC that took place last week, about the intersection of development, gentrification, mm-hmm. And social justice. We have a caller, Brandon in Baltimore. I think your question concerns that very issue. Welcome to Midday.
Yes, good afternoon. I did not exactly have a question. It's just to make a brief comment, and I'll just make this short. So speaking about the gentrification plans that's going on at the Harbor East concerning Perkins Homes, and as well as the coming further towards John Hopkins Hospital with the Douglas Homes initiative that's happening as we speak, because I'm pretty sure you wouldn't be able to take Perkins without having Douglas Homes in question. A lot of these public homes areas that, you know, you guys may have overlooked or haven't touched on, this was something that was in the making between the City of Baltimore, Department of HUB, 20 years ago, to be able to exactly begin moving out residents of the public homes area without having any submission of paper or demolition or permit, for that matter, for what happened with Lafayette Homes. And to bring it to, you know, a close as well, last year in 2017, Pleasant View Gardens Daycare Center actually were bought out for a dollar by Under Armour and Living Classrooms. So when we talk about gentrification and how that works between the area of Perkins Homes and Douglas Homes specifically, you start with the child care, you start with transportation, you eliminate the access to jobs, and those 732 families you speak of specifically, no one would know about them because they may or may not have obtained jobs afterwards, let alone adequate housing. So again, we have to look at history and let that be best proven to be the evidence that shows us that we're dealing with something that is much more of a microcosm that could be put in metrics, figures, and numbers, or specifically put intellectual, you know, dialogue. This is something that's being done targetedly and adversely to a community population.
Thank you for your comment, Brandon. I appreciate it. So, Melody, these are very raw issues. These are very difficult issues, and EBDI as an example of perhaps how some of those issues were not handled well,
right,
to say the least.
To say the least, indeed.
But here, I mean, Klaus talks about learning lessons. I mean, do you think with the kinds of plans they have, I mean, a new school, you know, a better addition of the Perkins Homes, I mean, a place that the people who currently live there could, you know, ostensibly live there again. I mean, are they starting to think about this in the right way?
I think that the initial conversation is productive. And I think what happens is like you throw spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks. And I think they're at that stage right now. Dr. Brown is one of many advocates who's been at the table, a lot of community people, a lot of Perkins residents and the Resident Advisory Council out there, the city council people are involved.
And that wasn't necessarily the case at EBDI.
No, yeah. Well, no. EBDI was a private nonprofit. Their meetings, their board meetings were never open to the public. We never saw their minutes. This was an ongoing, this went on for years. It's still ongoing. And so it's very difficult to get answers on that. And I do think that this particular project that's been proposed is already starting out with a public component to it, which is very healthy.
The fact is, when you look at the history of Baltimore, that a lot of people got displaced. A lot of people got stuck in not tenable housing conditions. The fact is that the whole country has an affordable housing crisis. The fact is that we have enormous amounts of people on waiting lists. And the fact is that we are not building more affordable housing than at best the same as before, after we did displace a lot of affordable housing. So these are all facts that make the discussion so hard. But on the other hand, you cannot just leave the status quo. Nobody could just go and say, well, if we had left Middle East alone and we had just not touched anybody, everything would be fine. Middle East was not fine
before. And that's the location of the EBDI
development. What's now called mm-hmm. Eagar Park. And the same is true for Perkins or for Lafayette or for any of these. Now, the past had sort of nuclear options that were sort of very drastic and very radical and go back to urban renewal and certainly to a history where Black people were displaced on purpose. But we are not in that time anymore. And so to take every proposal that's out there and nuke it down basically with the options of the past or with the practices of the past is also not productive, because that not doesn't get us anywhere.
Yeah, but Brandon's call, though, does, you know, exemplify the long history of mm-hmm. displacement and inequity and why there's a level of mistrust. That you can certainly understand that it's seated in fact, for sure. Let's see if we can sneak in one more call before we finish our segment. Greg in Butchers Hill, welcome to Midday.
Hi, I didn't think I was going to get in. Listen, I want to talk about the transit part of transit-oriented development. This is not a transportation project, but it is, sort of, because this total replacement, demolition and replacement scheme provides sort of a clean slate for all sorts of improvements. And the talk of lessons learned from EBDI, I was very disappointed that all the bare fields of the Middle East area were not improved to the point where, I mean, at the most, you could have extended the metro more cheaply up to the northeast, but at least you could have built some sort of transit center or some sort of transit lanes or even bike infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Greg. Appreciate the call.
Plans, too.
The master planners included at one point Mark Station mm-hmm. at the intersection right. with Broadway, with the idea that the metro line would intersect with the Mark line and that would be a transportation hub. Of course, it costs money, and the current, there's a lot of Mark plans are on the books and could be implemented tomorrow if we had the political will to do it.
Mm-hmm. So, Melody, give you the last word. Right now, transportation is not really a central dimension of this project.
It is not. Yeah. Right. It's such a big encompassing housing and land development issue, but transportation is one-third of it minimum.
Melody Simmons is a journalist who has covered Baltimore for more than three decades. She began when she was 12. She's currently the real estate and development reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. Klaus Philipson is an architect who writes and speaks regularly about city architecture, preservation, and urban transportation systems. His book is called Baltimore, Reinventing an Industrial Legacy City. I recommend it highly if you're interested in the history and options for the future when we talk about developing our city. He blogs at Community Architect. So thanks to you both, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Special thanks to Aaron Perez for his help putting this segment together. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Brittany Oliver joins us. She's the founding director of a group called Not Without Black Women. But before we go to break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2018, 87 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Three unidentified men and a woman killed the week before last have now been named by police. They are Damian Dowdridge, age 33, John Lee Brown, age 19, Raheem Bey, age 25, and Santana Williams, a young woman who was just 18 years old. Last week, 12 people were the victims of homicide in our city, including four people killed in double homicides. Marquise Patterson, age 22, and Pinky Louise Ruffin, age 65, as well as Clyde Burrell, age 66, and Rona Brand, age 54. The eight others who lost their lives last week are Jamar Hinton, age 34, Jared Watson, age 24, Randy Mayfield, age 23, Davon Gross, age 33, Ryan Dorsey, age 36, John Lynch, age 39, Walter Baines, age 30, and Oseas Diaz Ortiz. He was 26 years old. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.